As we continue our discussion of the major world religions, we discussed in our study last week three of the ones that we'll mention. First is the Baha'i Faith, which has its origin in Iran or Persia, which was monotheistic but different from Islam, and it was very ecumenical in its approach, that basically all religions have validity. The second was Buddhism, which had its origin in India, which, and again, with a number of these different religions, there is kind of a melding together, a blurring of the lines between philosophy and religion, especially when we get into the Eastern religions. Our concept of God is not something that you'll find in those various religions. So with regard to Buddhism, it's as much a philosophy as it is a religion. In fact, most Buddhists do not even believe in a God. But they do believe in nirvana, which is the ultimate reward of an individual who has, through multiple lives lived, where he reincarnated and reached higher and higher states of consciousness, he reaches that point where he escapes the cycle of life and death and reaches, as a result of that, nirvana. That particular philosophy has about 500 million adherents in the world, primarily there in India. Confucianism is from China. Confucius supposedly lived about five centuries before Christ. Very much a humanistic philosophy. Has two major components: the importance of humaneness, that is, compassionate toward one another, and a righteous or good life lived. And there are about 6 million adherents, primarily, again, in China, although Confucianism as a religion or as a philosophy has fallen out of favor. It's not nearly as influential as it has been in the past. The one that we're in now is Hinduism. We mentioned that or started that discussion last week. We talked about the fact that Hinduism, unlike a lot of these other religions, it's really not a single faith. It is something that is a synthesis more of Indian history and Indian culture. So when you talk to a Hindu and you ask them what does Hinduism stand for or what do Hindus believe, you're probably going to get a different answer depending on who you talk to. Because it's more of a synthesis of the various cultures and traditions. It's got very diverse roots. Unlike a lot of these other religions, there's no founder. It's just something that kind of organically came into being. And it started a long, long time ago, probably, again, five or six centuries before the birth of Christ. But if you get down to the fifth bullet point, if you have your handout with you, the four basic aims of the Hindu as he lives his life is to be successful in these four areas. The first is dharma, and that is fulfilling responsibilities with regard to ethics and the duties an individual has. So this would be the concept of good works in their faith. Artha, which is being successful and prosperous, having reference to material prosperity. The third is kama, which again is being what we might refer to as settled or having equilibrium with regard to emotions. It also is that aspect of sexuality that's under consideration in that. And then the fourth one, moksha, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing these words correctly, but that is liberation and freedom. And so those are the four aims of human life: to be free, to be prosperous, to be happy and fulfilled, and to be prosperous. And so this is what Hindus are striving for, very much a kind of a materialistic view, if you look at that. But they are very much like the Buddhists in that they believe in the concept of karma. That is what you get what you have coming to you. that what you dole out, you get in return. And of course, as we talked about with regard to Buddhism, that karma is not necessarily something that is going to be finding its expression in this life, though it can. In other words, I've mistreated someone, so somewhere later on in my life, I'm going to be mistreated as a result of it. But it certainly can be seen in the next life. And so, you hear it, we talk about it, for example, someone says, I want to live a good life, but I don't want to be born next time as a cockroach, and if you hear that kind of thing with regard to reincarnation. But there is that view that individuals will rise and fall with regard to their standing in the next life based upon the life that they are presently living. It's an interesting thing that, and again, both Buddhism and Hinduism come from the same culture, and there are some Hindus that consider Buddha as a deity, Buddha as a god. So, they kind of incorporate, again, it's a synthesis of many religions and many thoughts, and so it's very inclusive in that regard. There are a number of different scriptures, a number of different holy writings that I won't try to pronounce these. There are four that are mentioned, except for the Bhagavad Gita, which is one that you may have heard of. It's something that you hear about from time to time. But there are a number of major scriptures that they have and that they read and they follow. The thing that I find interesting with regard to Hinduism is their concept of God, because it's varied and it is very much polytheistic. That's one of the things that in the trip that I took over to India that became obvious. You have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of deities. And so you have various Hindu temples that will have a particular idol that has been erected, an image that has been erected in the middle of the temple. And depending upon which temple you go to, it might be a different god. And the gods are represented in a number of different ways with regard to multi-headed individuals, multi-armed individuals. That's, again, something you see fairly often in representations of Hinduism. When you have a god that's sitting in a lotus position and there's four arms sticking out on each side. Well, that's, it's just that kind of thing. But there are also representations of animals as well. So the concept of God is something that's fairly diverse in that regard. And there is a word that was used in describing this particular religion that I thought was interesting, because it's called henotheistic. So you hear of polytheism, and you hear of the idea that there is one god, or monotheism. Henotheism is basically an attitude that there are a lot of different gods, but I choose one of my favorite and I give my adoration to that person or to that god. So it's basically a concept of devotion to a single god that you choose as or is chosen for you as the one that is most special or personal to you, but that there are many gods that exist. Another thing that's interesting with regard to the Hindu religion is the existence of the caste system in India. And if you go and you read different views as to the origin of the caste system, some will say that it came about as a result of Hinduism. Some will say no, it already existed, or Hinduism was kind of alongside of it, but it wasn't the originator of it. But it certainly is something that is impactful. And the interesting thing with regard to the caste system, I'll just give it as an example. When I went over to India, and I don't know this for certain, it's a very complex thing, but I'm pretty sure that the entire time I was there, everyone that I saw was pretty much the same caste. It's just something that was kind of niggling at the back of my mind throughout this entire time. The caste system is a very rigid thing. For example, intermarriage in between the various castes, and there are dozens of them. I'm thinking that one number is something like 27 major castes, but that may be wrong. But the idea is there's not to be any intermingling with regard to the various castes. The Christians that we involved ourselves with We had opportunity to go and preach in some institutional congregations and made some headway with regard to teaching the truth with regard to the institutional issues. But all of those, they were of a fairly low caste. I don't know how low. That was never made clear to me, but fairly low caste. And I think that's one of the reasons why we were having such a difficult time making headway in converting anyone who is Hindu. We didn't have much of an opportunity, in other words. There was one lady that I came across that we actually studied with her and thought that she might would become obedient to the gospel, but she never did, and was Hindu. And we really had very little to do with any others. Now, we went and talked with those of Christian denominations, the Church of India, for example, and some Pentecostal groups. But just more, I mean, I studied a lot trying to find out a little bit about Hindu, got more confused as I went on. But I thought it's important for me to kind of know where they're coming from and never really had much of an opportunity. While we were there, our driver was an individual that the man that was hosting us was dismissive of. And we were kind of curious with regard to this because he was a very outgoing individual, a very kind individual, but he was very dismissive of the hired help. Now, when we think of that, we might think, well, you know, he's just the hired driver, and maybe that's why he's acting the way he is. But as a few days passed, we found out that he was of a lower caste, and he was being very dismissive of him. And we had to study with him and admonish him to say, you know, you don't treat him that way. And it's kind of an interesting thing because even though he was a Christian, this was something that was intrinsic in the culture and something that's very difficult for him to overcome. So the caste system is something that is very prevalent in India and is very much tied in with the Hindu religion. Okay, a couple of other things. If you'll notice the last three on the bottom of the page, most Hindus are vegetarians. Joshua Mahendranath, the man that again was hosting us, and his wife, she called him a heathen because he liked meat. and so it's not typical. And if you are fed meat, it's chicken. That's it. And that's all we had, chicken and rice and chicken the whole time we were there. But especially beef is something that would be verboten in India because of the fact that cows are revered. And I did see one occasion where there was a young boy, looked like he was 11, 12 years old, and he was leading a large calf around along. And the calf was dressed, had jewelry and a hat on, and real fancy. And he was waiting on and taking care of this. And it had some Hindu significance. I'm not exactly sure. I mean, you hear about how Hindus worship cows. I don't know how extensive that kind of thing is. But this calf was not going to be eaten anytime soon because he was very much revered in being led around and taken care of in that regard. So that's something that's typical that you see from time to time over in India as well. The central part of Hindu practice, the practice of the religion, it revolves around the temple worship. And so there are many, many Hindu temples, and they're very garish with regard to their colors and very intricate with regard to their architecture. And they're all over the place. But again, there are different temples for the different deities. And so there will be a central place in the temple with a path that is around it. And again, a Hindu concept that allows the worshiper to ritually circle the circle of the universal essence. So it's a part of that is to, and the reason why it's at the central of the path around it is so they can circle it as a part of their ritual. But again, saying worship, you know, it really doesn't have the same connotation that it does for us. So keep that in mind. One of the things that we alluded to, but I wanted to emphasize again, is yoga. I did it at another point, but I want to point out again that yoga, the practice of yoga, that is the stretching exercises that a lot of people do. You can join a yoga class. I think there's one in downtown River Oaks. The Indian word for path, or an Indian word for path. And what it means literally is, you know, put it kind of in a simple way, my yoga is the path that I take. So these are the principles that I follow. And so if you take a particular path to obtain a goal in life, that's considered your yoga. And it's something that's inclusive of diet, exercise, philosophies. And different individuals have different yogas or different paths. But the point that I wanted to make is that there are a lot of people who get involved in yoga, and they get involved in the philosophy of yoga. And as a result of that, it can be damaging to the faith. Now, as I said before, I don't think there's anything wrong with stretching or using the yoga poses with regard to stretching, but you have seen that. It's something that fairly prevalent on the West Coast for a long while, especially, where individuals began to take on the concept of the yin and yang and balance and have a philosophy of life that is very much a philosophy based on false religion. So it's something to be aware of and keep in mind. Over 80% of all Indians are Hindu. So it is the very large majority. And while we were over there, there were a couple of occasions just previous to our getting there where some Christian workers, and you know that's from the news reports and everything, so it very well may have been denominations, but they were actually attacked with rocks, rock throwing incidents that happened there. And some at that particular time, and I think it's continuing as much as a response to Islam as it is to Christianity. But the Hindus are becoming fairly militant. Like we're a Hindu nation. We don't want those other religions in here. And so there's some persecution of both Christian denominations as well as persecution of or conflict with Muslims in North India as a result of Hindu influence. Okay, so that's what I know about Hinduism. Anybody comments, questions before we go on? Very much an overview. And by the way, again, as you mentioned, that's the third largest religion in the world. It has 1 billion adherents. And India is a very populated area of the world. Okay, the next one is a very interesting one. It also comes from India. It's called Jainism. It's one of the oldest Indian religions. Its main emphasis is nonviolence. You're a Jainist. You have a committed Jainist. He is extremely careful. There are Jainist monks, and I remember just seeing a documentary about this one time, where they go barefooted, and they always look down on the ground as they're walking and walk slowly so as to not actually do harm to any living being. And that's inclusive of the smallest insect. And so they are very much centered around nonviolence, and the more committed Jainists are such toward any living thing, and that would be inclusive of, again, if you had a cockroach in your house, instead of stepping on the cockroach, you would catch the cockroach, and you would humanely take the cockroach somewhere else and get and let it go. They also are vegan, not just vegetarian, but vegan, because remember, vegan philosophy is also excludes dairy, but the reason why is because they contend that the extrication of dairy products is something that is not humane. It's something that is, I don't know if they would consider it painful or a form of violence, but they're very much a pacifistic group. You can imagine with that kind of thing being very much ascetic, and the term ascetic is contrasted to libertine. A libertine is one who is given to excess, who says there are no limits. An ascetic is an individual who self-limits. He dresses in very simple ways. He eats a very simple diet. He does not allow himself any of the pleasures of life. Well, that's the Jainist group, very much that way. And again, there are various levels of commitment. It's a very small religion, 4 to 6 million adherents that exist. But theirs is the same concept of karma, where by being nonviolent, being beneficial and helpful to all living beings, that as a result of that, when I am reincarnated, I might get a higher level to the point where I eventually reach nirvana. And so they believe that, basically in a sense, that men can become gods through this process of reincarnation and the raising of their karma to that level through nonviolence and good actions toward others. The one thing down here that I mentioned last week, because I thought it rather bizarre thing, they get this concept that you go up to different levels, and the second to the last level is that I become omniscient with action. And what that means is that I know everything, you know, I have that essence of God, and I do things. So if in that concept, Jehovah God would be the second highest level of the Jainist thinking. Omniscience, omnipotence, a creator. Because the most divine and perfect essence is omniscience at rest, where all it is knowledge and awareness, and there is no doing. That's ultimately what the Jainist desires to reach. And the belief is that by continuing the karma, you can reach that point. Okay? That's Jainism. Anybody comments, questions? Going over real quickly. I don't want to, if I'm confusing anyone, I don't want to rush past. Okay, the next religion is the Shinto religion, which is from Japan. And this is what we might refer to as the state religion of Japan. And the Japanese are, again, when we're looking at religion, we're looking at something very different from Western religion, what we practice, because of their oriental views that exist. For example, is polytheistic, like the Hindus are, and others that we've mentioned. That it's a form of nature worship in the sense that it is their belief that deity or the divine essence can manifest itself in animate and inanimate objects. And so that would be inclusive of rocks, trees, rivers, animals, places, and even people. In fact, I may be mistaken with regard to this. It's been a while since I've read about it, but I do believe that Mount Fuji is considered a holy place. As a part of that, the divine essence being there in that place. Now, with regard to the Shinto religion, there are, as noted in the handout, 81,000 shrines or temples. And there are 85,000 Shinto priests. Not a priest like we think of a priest. They're more basically caretakers of the various shrines or temples, which are located in various places. Some are in the city, some are in the country, some are at a place in nature or an object in nature that is considered inclusive of the divine essence. They'll be located at that. And the interesting thing about it is the Shinto shrines are places to go to obtain purification. So it's not worship per se, but a desire for the individual who is an adherent in this to receive some type of purification. So the desire of those who go to this particular religion, it's not so much concerned with what comes after, but rather to cleanse impurity, because if you have impurities in your life, that's going to impact your peace of mind. So you're not going to be happy. You're not going to be at ease with regard to your mind. And it also is something that can be impactful of your fortune. So a person who has impurities, he's not going to be happy. Things are going to go well for him in life. And so these purification rites are more practical in the sense that it's a means of obtaining good fortune and an ease of mind. And so that's what these purification rites are for. So it is inclusive of talismans and amulets that are personal items that are worn for protection and welfare. And so it's in this particular case, it's very much a, I don't want to say practical, but a, well, let me just give you a parallel. Social gospel. You have in it's a movement that actually started in the 19th century here in America, where the idea was, as Christians, we need to be less concerned with heaven, less concerned with getting to heaven, more concerned with helping our fellow man. And as a result of that, the social gospel began. That the purpose of churches, the purpose of Christians, is to benefit the welfare of man in general. The Salvation Army is the preeminent example of this. The Salvation Army spends the majority of its time and efforts in, you know, helping the poor and the soup kitchens and all of those kinds of things because they're wanting to make things better on earth. Well, that's kind of the way the Shinto religion is, trying to make things better on earth. The other thing that's kind of interesting with regard to this, the Shinto priests. You hear about Shinto priests in the area of martial arts. And not all of them, but one of the primary things of importance with regard to the Shinto religion is physical grace and physical welfare, physical ability. And as a result of that, with regard to, you know, most of the martial arts are oriental in their derivation, either in China or Japan or some of the other oriental countries and nations. And so those various martial arts are very much involved with their concepts of religion and philosophy. That's the case not only with Shinto, but also the Taoism, which is Chinese. A lot of the priests in that are very much associated with martial arts as well. Okay, so that's the Japanese major religion, and as a result of that, we're told that 80% of the Japanese people practice to some extent for another, even if they don't formally identify as Shintoists, I suppose, they nevertheless are influenced by that with regard to visiting of the various shrines and the practices of purification.
Same.
Yeah.
When you think about the small country Japan is, and like there's 81,000 shrines, there really are shrines as you're walking down the street, though, the little cove over here with the shrine, and lots of medallions and things on shops and stuff like that.
But very much part of
the shrines in the hotels. They're going to the hotel lobby.
Well, it was interesting. There is, as I was going through and studying this, I saw a link that I thought was kind of interesting. It says, how to become a Shinto priest. And so I clicked on it, and there was a list of things that you do, and you have to, some education you have to receive and everything. But apparently there are online things that you can do to become a Shinto priest. And then, once you're a Shinto priest, you can establish a shrine here in America. And you're the caretaker of that shrine, and it's a money-making proposition, because with regard to the sale of the personal amulets, those kinds of things as a part of it, that as the caretaker, it's a form of commerce. So it's very much involved in the Japanese culture. So
refine the statistics a little bit, just for interest's sake. About 127 million people live in Japan. Only 40% of those are religious at all. 35% are Buddhists. And actual Shinto is only like 3 or 4%. Christians are 1 or 2%. So actual Shinto is very small.
Again, the information I got from, in this case, was on the Wikipedia page. And that they did make it very clear that I may have written that down wrong then. Because that obviously
doesn't make sense. This comes from surveys.
8% is 80%.
Yeah, these were Japanese surveys performed in 2000.
Yeah, but the reason I'm saying that is because 80%, 4 million is not 80% of the people in Japan.
No, 127.
So it may be 8%. I don't know how that works out. But again, when you're talking about the culture, and then that one exercise, because I'm sure that 80% number is inaccurate. I'm sorry. I have to go back and look. If I looked at it carefully, I would have saw that wasn't the case. But anyway, with regard to that, they said that even those that do not identify specifically as being Shinto in their religion, that it's very much part of the culture and their influence to a certain extent or not, more culturally than religiously with regard to those things. But I have to go back and look at the Wikipedia page to find out what the figure is, because that's obviously incorrect. Yeah.
It says, and on that page, Shinto is the largest religion in Japan, practiced by nearly 80% of the population. Yet only a small percentage of these identify themselves as Shintoist in surveys.
So that's what it said on the page. Hmm. Okay. All right. Well, so there's a contradiction then. So I don't know where they got that number. So the 80% number I typed in was correct. But I don't know where the 4 million. The 4 million was in there as well on the same page. Jesse?
One understand Shinto is more of the religion for the aristocracy. Those who are kind of the old guard, those who have a heritage tracing back centuries, often to, you know, those of the samurai families who were also expected to have that same Shinto background and a higher culture. Those who the Buddhists are more like the younger generations who are the more middle class people. Same thing kind of like with Christianity, of the younger generation wants the, no harsh words, everyone just gets the ecumenicalism. That's kind of the same thing. That's the Buddhism is a better version of that.
Okay, well, that just shows you how y'all know more about it than I do. Okay, the next religion that we wanted to look at, and again, we're trying really to get through all these, is Sikhism. I have actually had, and I looked for this and wasn't able to find enough about it to spend much time on it. I should have thought about it and gone back, but my wife's surgeon, when she hurt her shoulder, he was a Sikh, and it was interesting because of just his the very very dedicated physician, very concerned for the welfare of others. He was it a turban that he wore? Never. I think he had some kind of headpiece that he wore, and he was bearded, and I forget exactly the situation, but there's a ceremonial dagger that either he kept on him at all times or else he told us about. I don't remember, but there are certain things about this this religion that are fairly interesting. But I think the important tenets that you'll notice, which is the third bullet point there, is a faith in one creator God. So it is a monotheistic faith, and it has its origin in South Asia. Unity and equality of all humankind, and the animating tenet, in other words, that which very much impacts how they act, is the need to engage in selfless service, strive for social justice and honest conduct and livelihood. And so you have those who are adherents to this religion, diligent in that regard. You'll often find them in places like various types of service, including physicians and so on and so forth. Another interesting thing about this is that you hear about gurus and Indian gurus, and Sikhism is based upon the teachings of a specific guru that lived in the 15th century. His name is Guru Nanak. And then there were, as he started this, he had 10 successors that followed after him. And by that time, the religion itself was fleshed out with regard to its tenets and its beliefs. The concept of God, though we say monotheistic, is very different from what we think of God in Christian Judaism and even Islam concepts. Because their concept of God is, again, more of an idea of an essence rather than a person. And you'll find a lot of this with regard to the Oriental religions, especially, is the idea of a personal God is something that's a little bit different from what they have. They have a nebulous concept of God that might permeate certain things, but as far as an individual God, it's not there. So they have the concept of God as that which is constant in the universe, the origin of all things, the reason all things subsist and consist, but there's no gender, there's no form, there's no person. It's a nebulous and broad thing that they have. So it's not something to where they worship per se. What they do is meditate and recite. And so they have recitations, various writings that they recite and meditate, and that's called remembrance. And that's one of the major tenets of the Sikh life, and the second is service. So, again, what this individual, and again, he was a very diligent man and a very nice individual. He was very diligent with regard to his service to mankind in the sense of him being a physician and one who was very concerned about his patients and go the extra mile with regard to that. If you ever have a Sikh doctor, you probably got a pretty good one because of that desire and that attitude. But the second thing is the concept of remembrance, the meditation and recitation that they have as a part of their daily life. And again, something similar to some of the Christian principles, but then sometimes far different. Another aspect is the peculiarity with regard to their dress, their demeanor. For example, some sects, some parts of the Sikh religion, they will not allow men to cut their hair. And so the men have long hair. And in addition to that, those use of intoxicants, including tobacco, is something that's prohibited in that religion. All right. Anybody else seen a Sikh? Probably seen them. I've seen them in the movies before. But there are not too many of them either. About 25 million adherents, and most of them in that region of the world. Okay, the last two that we have. First one is Taoism.
Taoism.
Say it again.
Tao, like Z-O-W-E-S-M.
Okay.
Taoism.
Okay, thank you. So, can you tell us about it?
No. But I can tell you about Chinese people and general as far as religion goes.
Okay.
When we lived in Taiwan and worshipped there, we lived there for 2 years. Taoism is part, Buddhism is part. But when the preachers that we knew went to convert the local population, they were like, great, we all worship Jesus. And we just include him in with everything else. So it was very difficult to convert those people to give up their ancestor worship and everything else and just have God our Father and the one God idea.
That's kind of interesting. It parallels what we actually talked about last week in Acts 17 with regard to Paul's addressing the Athenians, because they had that same kind of a concept as the Jehovah God that he spoke about was one of many. And yeah, we'll worship him too. We don't know who he is, but we'll worship him. And what Paul established very clearly is that this God, he's not worshipped in temples. This God is not one that can be put in a niche. This God is all pervasive and glorious and the one true God, and Jesus is his son and Messiah. And so that's not a principle that is going to be easy for people who have been raised differently to understand. Again, Taoism, thank you, is a philosophical, ethical, or religious tradition of Chinese origin. The beginnings are attributed to the earliest of Chinese literature, and that word Tao means path. The flow of the universe is the force behind all. Again, something fairly nebulous. And when it comes to origin, it's hard to know exactly where its origin came from. There are mythologies with regard to a figure. His name is Laozi, L-A-O-Z-I. Again, pronunciation, I'm sure not anywhere close. But there's no way of establishing that. As a historical figure, there's just not any evidence in that regard. So all the claims are mythological, about 4th century B.C. And it's similar, and again, Chinese Taoism and Confucianism come from the same place, so it's very similar with regard to ethics and the emphasis on ethics. But it's interesting is that our Confucianism is very rigid with regard to castes and with regard to your place. With Taoism, it's very much different, and they're competing philosophies.
Yeah, well, they don't know if they existed or not. But I can give you some historical context for the time period that this supposedly came from. They had first the Spring and Autumn period, then the Warring States period. It's all warfare, 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 all this warfare. But the problem was, everyone was kind of too evenly matched. So it was just always warfare, and no one was winning. So what became very, very valuable was ideas. The people who had the philosophical thoughts and could give you an advantage in this sort of thing. And it went on to the 100 school period, I think it was. And anyway, that's kind of the time where this sort of thing came about, where thought was greatly valued, different types of thought, different ways of achieving what you want.
Thank you. Interesting. All these things are very interesting. You'll notice the emphasis in regard to this particular religion. And these are things that we would say are appealing, the idea of compassion, moderation, and humility. But again, depending upon the adherent and how strongly they hold these principles, and this may be very much in contrast, as Bonnie said, to the warfare of the time in this view, what is, when we talk about compassion, what is compassion? Well, compassion means you don't go to war. No warfare, no aggressiveness toward anyone. In fact, compassion would include not only war, but also capital punishment. So there are very many who hold to that particular view. So when we think about compassion, we may have a different view of that than what they do. The second of these two are moderation. And again, moderation has been referred to as an absolute simplicity of living. So if we say we want to live in moderation, that means we don't want two cars, we just want one. We don't want a 60-inch TV, a 48-inch would be fine. But when they talk about moderation, they talk about rice, barefoot, small house, the simple aspects of life. The third thing is humility. And when we talk about humility, it's an unwillingness to assert yourself. And so when we talk about humility, we can think about Jesus as being most humble, but there were occasions where he asserted himself. It was right and appropriate, but there are some pretty extreme views with regard to this as a part of that philosophy. Again, adherents often practice vegetarianism and often martial arts, so it's another religion where the idea of race and physical skill and physical abilities and, of course, discipline is a big part of martial arts, but that's something that they really appeals to. And again, active adherents, according to the Wikipedia site I went to, 12 million, though up to 173 million Chinese practice some tenets of the religion. And I'm sure that these are, again, surveys that are taken with regard to it. Okay, we're basically out of time, and what I'm going to do next week is we're going to get into our discussion of the some of the... I've got a book. It's called Alleged Discrepancies of the Bible. And I'm kind of looking through that and looking at some other resources that I have. And we're not going to go into great detail. We're just going to kind of look at some general concepts or thoughts that the Bible contradicts itself. And as such, the claims of inspiration are invalid. And some of the claims have made, we've talked about in times past, for example, with regard to the contradictions in the various manuscripts. That might well be an attack that will be made. So we're going to try to explain why such claims are invalid. And we'll have maybe a representative example of those kinds of things. But again, there are so many claim discrepancies. And there are some legitimate difficulties in various texts. When you take, for example, just very simply, Matthew's genealogy of Christ, Luke's genealogy of Christ, they don't match up. Oh, discrepancy. There's the Bible contradicts itself. And so those kinds of things are things that you have to deal with and you have to be aware of. And know you don't have the answer to all of them, because if you studied all that you think are there, someone can come up with another claim. But they fall in different broad areas, and we're going to try to just kind of make note of those kinds of things. And that's going to basically end our study of apologetics. And I'm not sure exactly, I've not finished the material, I'm not sure how long it's going to take with regard to it. We're not going to spend a great deal of time on that either. And so we're pretty close to getting to an end of our study of apologetics. And I'm going to do something easier next time. So we'll see what happens with regard to it. But what we'll do is pick up with this final one, Zoroastrianism. Zoroastrianism. I tell you, they didn't remember how to pronounce it. And I looked it up. That's how it's pronounced. Zoroastrianism. And we will pick up by looking at that for a few moments, and we'll have a handout for the alleged discrepancies, and that's what we'll do next week. All right. Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention today.